Thank you so much. Well, Andrea, welcome to the Future Lab. This is quite an exciting endeavor and a little bit new to many of us. We're kind of exploring new themes, new fields. The students in the Future Lab, a lot of them are architects and designers. Some are from computer science, computer networking, and mathematicians. So it's somewhat interdisciplinary, but and coming really at the topics from different angles. And today we're sort of kicking off a healthcare and health-related set of conversations. And I have a few questions ready to go. And then usually 25 minutes into the hour, we let students ask questions and they either type them in the chat or we will encourage them to just unmute their microphone and say so. And I'm realizing that a lot of our themes are starting to have overlaps. So we talked about home and living yesterday and multi-generational housing came up, which makes a lot of sense. And we're now, I'm curious about your take on kind of aging in place and aging in general. And Monique mentioned that you were on a summit on isolation this morning, possibly. And so I'm wondering, can you give us a sense of how people are doing out there? How is the aging population at home and in assisted living handling the conditions?
Well, I think it's incredibly tough. I think that for those who are already struggling, it's much, much worse than it was before. So I think just like with every vulnerable group, this pandemic has really exposed the fissures and the inequality. And that's an inequality in how people are treated in terms of their race, how they're treated in terms of their age, how we're treated in terms of our economic status. And so all of the things that were already difficult are much more difficult. So, for example, our office has really turned into majority of the time is really focused on food delivery. So things like people just not having enough food to eat and people calling us that never have called us before, which I guess is a good thing because now we're able to connect with them more than we did before. But I think that people are if they have social connections, they tend to be doing a lot better. So if they are connected in their buildings, in their neighborhoods, in their communities, then a lot of times they'll reach out and say, someone is checking on me, someone is asking about me, I take a walk with my friend in the neighborhood, that kind of thing. And so, of course, those people are doing better. People who already maybe were isolated, either in senior buildings that they didn't necessarily feel safe in or didn't feel for whatever reason, then of course that's all been exacerbated. And so not a surprise, but just definitely a deepening of all of the things that were difficult before. So again, some people are doing really well. And if they have they have access to technology, they can take advantage of things being done online, all the programming that has been moved online. But many people, I'll talk to someone and I'll say, can I send you an email? And she says, listen, we're lucky that we have a phone. A lot of us around here are lucky we have phones. So it's such a wide, honestly, range of people and issues that I'm noticing right now.
That makes a lot of sense. And maybe this is an opportunity to talk a little bit about what you guys are doing in general, what you did pre-COVID, and what is added now, like how do you guys try to address that beyond food, which is obviously really, really essential, but what else is going on in your institution?
Yeah, so we were formerly called the Elderly Commission, and now we're called the Age Strong Commission. And I think was it Gregory who introduced our commission earlier?
Yes.
He did a very good job, actually, of encapsulating what it is that we do. We have a nutrition program, so a lot of the funding that comes through Meals on Wheels goes through our office and goes to various basically organizations. We have transportation that we provide. It's a free service where we're giving, you know, thousands of rides a year, mainly to medical appointments, but also to grocery stores. We have an advocacy unit where people can call with any number of issues. And we have about 12 advocates who serve neighborhoods. We have events. Normally we do hundreds of events actually a year. And we also do advocacy and housing. We have a housing unit, incredibly important. And they are people that can help people sign up for subsidized housing, for elder housing, to go to court with someone who might be in the process of being evicted, help them, with any variety of housing issues. And I work on a special initiative that kind of exists within the commission, and it's called Age Friendly Boston. And Age Friendly Cities has been around for many, many years. It was started by the World Health Organization in 2006 in response to two demographic trends, which were the rapid aging of the population internationally and the large number of people living in cities. So really to look at how does a city adapt to an increasing older population? What are the procedures, policies, services that have to be in place? So that's what I work on. We've made a lot of improvements as a result of this initiative. We've added benches in the city. We have a public restroom map and these things are good for people of any age. We have a cooking class series that we've done for over 2 years. We have put recommendations for more age-friendly housing into our required checklists within the city when people are building housing. So we've had a lot of different places that we've tried to make an impact with this initiative.
That brings up a good question about, you mentioned benches and you mentioned sort of, measures that are put in place to make cities, but also maybe buildings more generation friendly, because they're also great for very young people. What other architectural or urban conditions could you see being implemented? So I've been involved with the Placemaking Network, for example, in Boston, and they talked a lot about events, not so much spatial interventions, but actually bringing people together, which now in the age of COVID comes with a whole another set of connotations. So how do you do the things you do now in this under these new with this sort of paradigm shift? And what do you see the role of place being?
So one of the things we've done, and this is not accessible to everyone, unfortunately, is we have moved some of our programming online. And we know that's not sufficient, because I would say, and this is not a scientific point, but I think almost a third of the people that we serve do not have access to either internet or computers. And so it's, filling a need for a certain segment of the population that are grateful to have it. So we have moved some things online. I don't think that's necessarily the answer, but I think that it has provided some needed activities and programs. I mean, we've had the cooking classes, for example. We used to have about 40 people show up in person. Now we have we've had 130 show up in the webinar. So we have been able to reach more people as a result. So it would be really nice in a way to expand the number of, I don't believe the technology is the answer to all of our problems, but I think it would be nice to have more people to be able to take advantage of, if they want to have the ability to either through, better arrangements with different organizations to really help people learn this technology so that they can do this. But in terms of place, I think what we're looking at is very practical kinds of things that are, when we're doing patio seating, for example, the city is trying to allow restaurants to be able to reopen, which of course is one of the most difficult things. And so there's a lot of planning going on around how do we widen the sidewalk? How do we, Brookline has done this actually, where they've taken part of the road and had people be able to safely walk, and then it leaves the sidewalk available for other things, including cafes and outdoor dining. So I do think that that's probably a really important thing to do, to really look at our how we're using our public space. And it's a good idea no matter what, even if there isn't a pandemic, right? Because we want people to be able to use our common resources safely and be included. So we always knew that for older adults, you know, going out in the public, depending on your age, was always a challenge because people said, well, we want to know that we have someplace to rest if we're going to the market or pay a bill or whatever. We'd like to know that there's a place we can rest along the way or there's a restroom along the way. So it's very important. And then, you know, in addition, I think that having safer streets by having them be wider, having more tree cover, which is really important for people because older people are more susceptible to heat and to the intense, you know, increase in heat at this, that's coming as a result of climate change. So in a way, this is a huge opportunity to do things that we already were planning on doing or should have been doing. So it's sort of necessitating a quicker response, you know, which is very good. You know, making the streets more all age friendly, all user friendly. So these are very good changes that I think can come out of this. So I don't know if that answers that question.
It does. It does. Thank you so much. And several speakers have brought up, you know, a sense of hope and opportunity that somehow the situation accelerates the bad and the good. So it accelerates or it intensified some of the inequalities that you have pointed out in terms of access to technology and just accessibility of venues and technology altogether. But it also brings out the use of the streets, more pedestrian areas, maybe more bike lanes that a lot of people have been pushing for. So I just read somewhere that 50% of Americans report feeling lonely, and probably by now it's more. So these are not just the elderly, these are now all age groups. And I can certainly attest to my teenagers feeling lonely, even though I'm in the building, by missing their friends and by missing their peer groups. And so maybe there's similarly an opportunity to bring these age groups together and somehow combat this now as a multi-generational endeavor. Do you see any more formalized initiatives happening out there that would allow this now just kind of ad hoc kind of scenarios to happen?
A couple of different ideas. Before this happened, we had a program called the Intergenerational Home Share Program. And it was matching graduate students, mainly graduate students, with older adult homeowners in the hopes that it will help older adults keep their homes and age in their communities, as well as give college students, graduate students, people struggling financially, an affordable place to live in a different kind of setting than what they normally have. So that's something we really, really believe in, and in continuing that. At this point, very difficult. They have changed their platform to actually be a volunteer matching program. So that's very, very good. So instead of people living with older adults, they are matching them to either have a pen pal, to do wellness checks, to go to the grocery stores for specific needs. And this has been a really great, flexible, turnaround, sort of adaptation of this program. So now it's a volunteer matching program. So that's something the city is doing, and I feel very good about that. We also have a Boston Public School exchange where Boston Public School students have drawn these absolutely beautiful illustrations and drawings that we are going to deliver to older adults. Then the mayor's office is asking older adults to record congratulations for their graduation, for students' senior graduation. So I think the awareness is really happening where that, you know, the mayor's office, which may not have considered the Age Strong Commission, is saying, listen, we would like to have some older people wish the graduating seniors well and wish them congratulations and then go to us and ask them, you know, ask us to see if we could get, you know, older residents to do that. So I think on a city level, there is a much more, I would say, collaboration going on about this issue and the need for intergenerational, the way that our places look, the way that our public space looks, the way that we do everything, because we really have been very, very segregated. And most housing And this is something that we talked about in the isolation summit. It's putting people in all of one, you know, similar age group in one place, and then add 20% people with disabilities. That's Boston Public Housing. That's the general way that it's been done. So I think that that's really not good. I mean, we're lucky we have it because it's affordable housing. But generally speaking, we're really trying to push even the city to really support the idea of housing that is intergenerational, that is not done in the same way that we've been doing things before. Just even all senior buildings, even, you know, I think we should get away from that personally.
So you would suggest, a bigger mix or more integrated. Yeah. And I think in some societies, that's still very, very common. So I'm from Germany, and my grandfather for many, many years in his 90s lived in a house where the attics of these houses were always rented out to students. So the apartments that got the hardest and are the smallest and are the cheapest. And he made such good friends with them. They got all his IT going for him, all his technology going, and he told them stories and, you know, bought meals once in a while. So I just remember how unbelievably fond they were of each other in a completely unorganized setting. It just happened that they were in the same building. And so that mix seems to create opportunities automatically. And I am very sure that he was able to age in place until age 97 because these students lived above him and kind of took care of some pressing needs there. So what do you see the challenges being for aging in place versus, retirement homes or sort of more dedicated settings now that we have COVID-19 hitting and which changes the conditions somewhat?
Well, I think the challenges are maintenance. Home maintenance is a big issue. Property taxes, that seems to be an issue. People do want to remain in their communities. They really do. That is, I think, the preferred choice. People are afraid oftentimes of going to assisted living or to a nursing home. There are times when obviously it does make sense, I think, to have the additional help. But I think if we can, I do think as much as possible to keep people in their homes as long as possible. I do think that's the way to go. And I think but living alone is very hard. And so having someone in your home to help, you know, just even the loneliness factor, I think is really, really important. So we're very committed to that program. And I do think that people want to remain in their communities if they can. Then you have stories of people that really love going to these more of assisted living type of arrangements. But generally speaking, those are very expensive. They're very costly. A good one is very costly. I do think there's advantages to having your peers around you. There's some that are just amazing. You know, it's like their dining rooms and, you know, there's a LaSalle Village in Newton, which is like this incredible place. And you're in a, you know, college situation where you can take classes, but you're on a campus and you can take classes. So that's a very, very nice arrangement for people. But I think, I think if we really want to promote this idea of a city that is truly multi-generational, multiracial, representatives of every class live there, you don't really want to lose the people that, you know, have lived in the city for 50, 60 years and lose that sense of community. So I think that a home repair is very important. And so that's something that we've really tried to step up on our end. We have a senior home repair program. And then the social isolation part as well. So either by having people live with, you know, with older residents or connecting people to services, connecting them to any number of things that are going on. And, a lot of this, the issue of social isolation is also for people to not only be served, but also to serve. And I think to also get away from this idea that older people are passive and have to be served. Because what really helps, I think, to address, you know, loneliness is really to feel, to serve, to be of service to one another. It's true for any age group. And I think that that's something that we have to really start thinking in those terms. You know, yes, it's about a pass, you know, not everybody is passive. So what can someone do to feel a part of where they are and valuable and important to that neighborhood. And that's why when we do the intergenerational home share, we often say, you're actually helping a student by doing this. Because if it's always seen as, I want to need to be helped, sometimes I think that's a problem for some people. I don't think that's always a good place for someone to be.
I would agree with that. And it feels so good to contribute somehow, to be part of sort of a purpose. And I would agree with that. I think it brings up, especially for the architects in the room, a question about how our housing is configured, what the sizes of these units are, what I think many of us might have seen parents aging in a relatively large home that was great for, you know, when 5 or 6 people lived in it, but for 1 or 2, it's really not efficient anymore. So I think it brings up typologies and how we arrange housing and how is access to community even possible in the way we pattern our suburbs or our cities. And there's a lot of opportunity in there, but right now, if we stick with the typologies that everybody seems to favor, there's some huge disadvantages there, and they're just not very flexible. So I'm hoping that the design community will step up to create more flexibility. Where do you think are the roadblocks, and what is mostly in the way? You laid out a beautiful vision of you know, this mix of people and accessibility and benches, and but also activities and educational opportunities. Where do you think the roadblocks are?
I mean, I think that clearly funding is always an issue, and whether we're putting the necessary resources into the right places. And so often things are, and I don't know, I'm not an expert on this at all, but there are limits because of the way that a certain grant might be written. So I think sometimes we get boxed in by our system, which is that, you know, that's earmarked for affordable housing. That's Boston Housing Authority funds. They can only be used in this way. So breaking through a lot of the things that we think, you know, the way things were done have to be done that way. The way things are designed have to be done the way they were designed before. They don't necessarily, but a lot of it is mired in very, you know, it gets these tangled webs, you know, even something as simple as a bench, whose property is it? You know, is it on the close, is it the side close to the business and then they have to maintain it? Is it the side closest to the street? So because of some, you know, like in issues of legality, even, you know, like who's going to maintain it? Who's going to take care of it? So I think sometimes those things get in the way of bigger, of making more change. Like, for example, but this is interesting, things can change. We had a senior center in Roxbury, in Dorchester. And we wanted to slow the traffic down there because it became a senior center. It was a youth center that then got changed into a senior center. And seniors were saying, listen, Pete, they're just speeding by. It's a crossways between Columbia Road and Blue Hill Avenue, and they're cutting down Geneva Avenue. And when we first went to the city, they said, you know, because of the classification of that road, that you can't put a traffic calming, you couldn't put a speed bump there because of the classification of the road. Then somehow, Department of Transportation, with all these different efforts, with, you know, all these different groups getting involved, now there's going to be a speed table on Geneva Avenue between Columbia Road and Blue Hill Avenue. So I don't know what changed, really. But what I do know is when multiple organizations, agencies get together, they start to see that there's a way to change something like that, where they originally said, nope, nothing we can do. The law says you can't put a speed table there. And then somehow there's a way that's found if there's consistent pressure from both the community and these different organizations. So that's the answer to the roadblock. The answer to the roadblock is multiple partners, multiple voices, and consistent advocacy.
Thank you. Yeah, I think that's really hopeful. And I think there's often these rules and regulations seem very, very firm, and they're in the way for seemingly no good reason. And so if you push hard enough, but it takes somebody to push, and it's sometimes they're not around or they don't have the stamina. I see Dave Marrera joined us. So welcome, Dave, to the conversation. I just saw him. Here he is. So Dave, we were just talking about what the biggest roadblocks are to implementing sort of crossing over between generations, better places within the cities, better accessibility. So, and we've addressed quite a few questions. We had, Andrea, we had Taylor and Wandi from the Housing Innovation Lab yesterday. So they were talking about some of these initiatives as well, which are quite fabulous. And so to get back to COVID-19 and its impact, because that's going to be what we're addressing in the Future Lab and in the future scenarios that students will be creating. What has surprised you the most, or what came most unexpectedly in terms of the fallout of what we've been going through, and now we're seeing kind of the opening up, and what do you anticipate? So looking back maybe for a minute and then looking ahead, what are you expecting?
I think it's a tough time because we really don't know if there's any time where we have to live in the moment. It's right now. It's very hard to predict what the future will bring. And I think especially for older adults, for example, we were working on employment for older adults because we saw that that was an issue that came out of multiple data points that we were able to collect, that people wanted to work because of economic insecurity or wanting to be productive or whatever the reason was. So we had a lot of things that we were working on. And now we have 40 million people that have applied for unemployment. And the issue, the question will be, will older people get some of the jobs that come back, or will they try to, or will they go to younger people who are not being told that they're going to have to stay home or limit their time, you know, out in the community. So I think we're in a very tough time because we're trying to break through one of the most persistent isms, which is ageism. And yet at the same time, we have this very real statistic, a very real issue that older people are more susceptible somehow to this virus. And so it's very tough because there's nothing like having someone say, well, you know what, you may have to stay home. Old people 60 and over may have to stay home even after stay-at-home orders are lifted. So that's tough to hear because, like I said, we're trying to say, you know what, we're equal. We, you know, people should not have barriers to employment, shouldn't have barriers. We want to help lift those and remove those. And yet, so I'm not sure what the exact answer is. I do know that there may be some opportunities, again, that come out of this. If there are more flexible work environments, for example, or work arrangements that are going to come out of this, like more people working at home, that actually could benefit an older worker in the end, because they could say, listen, I that would be better for me anyway. And then this would be, it's a very good thing for an employer to entertain allowing a portion of workers to be able to remain at home and work. So I think that a lot of the solutions that are coming are, like I said earlier, are solutions that we always needed. And so that's the hopeful part of this. And so maybe these things are going to happen a little more quickly. So maybe, for example, the public realm is really going to be truly responsive to the needs of every user, every age group. And so that's a real positive that could come out of this. There's a sense of emergency about this, to allow people to have space, allow people to be safe. So that's always was necessary, and now it's going to happen. And in terms of these other things, maybe it's just about being more aware of what people's needs are, to say, listen, we know that, say, for example, a diverse workplace is a better workplace for everyone. If you're looking at the bottom line, it's a more profitable workplace. It's a more diverse in terms of ideas, in terms of energy. So is this an opportunity to then say, you know, because of the highlight on our vulnerable communities, is it an opportunity to say, this is why, you know, include old, I'm just using the workforce thing because it's been on my mind, and because it's going to be a hard one to overcome. Could you look at it in a different way and say, actually, this is a great opportunity for us to, you know, to expand utilizing the skills of an older worker and allow them to do it in a way that, you know, maybe we wouldn't have before. So that's just one idea. is that some of these challenges could actually lead to a greater, you know, visibility of older people without stigma, without stigmatization. And that's the hard part I'm wrangling with. But we must do that. We must do
Thank you. Yeah, I think this, what you said, is really getting to a lot of very, very crucial points on the, again, positive side, and then on the also possibly disadvantageous side, where somebody might decide not to hire somebody at a certain age because they're not as flexible. I would agree with that, and that's a really reasonable concern. Thank you so much. Dave, did you have any questions to add before I turn it on, turn it over to the students?
No, I think you covered some of it. We've worked on some projects together, and I know how many challenges they get in Andrea's office. I feel like you do a great job at addressing these issues. We talked about isolation, depression. We're working on a BPS project together. Just finding ways to, again, the common denominator of bringing people together. But really, no. Andrea puts up with me. Andrea puts up with me on the phone, so I don't have any extra questions.
Thank you, Dave. I'm really impressed by, you know, all the initiatives and all the things you've mentioned: education, transportation, events, housing. I mean, that's an incredible. That's the entire life of a person. So that's almost all aspects covered. And in a way, I wish there was, you know, for all age groups, there were agencies who help with that kind of stuff, without necessarily separating out how old you are, or why, you know, why you might need that assistance.
So. One thing I forgot to mention, Anne, is that we have a volunteer program as well. We have a volunteer unit, and that's actually one of the most important things that we do. And I can't believe I didn't mention it, but to go back to this idea of feeling useful and productive, and even if it's a small amount of money that people are getting, because it is a small amount of money, it's a very valuable program. And so I think this idea of volunteering, of giving back, of being in productive work environments where you can feel useful and valuable is a really important thing as we grow older. Now, I'll give you an example. We actually had a really amazing exchange a day at the prison in Dorchester, where volunteers went and sat with inmates. And that's another great intergenerational idea, but it was just amazing because here we had older people, some of whom, actually a few of whom, one of whom, who I think had also been incarcerated and had also worked, had a very tough life. And these are people that really had a lot to share. And it was just amazing to see the exchange of these two groups. And so I think our volunteer program is very important because it really provides that opportunity that people feel they can still learn things that are new. Then a lot of times our volunteers are teaching things, like they're doing taxes for older people, you know, tax preparation. We're training them to do things, financial literacy. So I guess my takeaway for all of this is not to make people feel disempowered or othered, but very much a co-creator in our lives, in our own lives, which everyone needs to do at any age, and not to have that change at a certain age, that everybody's, you know, feeble and frail and can't do things. And you know, people really need to be treated with equality. I notice we even do this in our own commission, our seniors or this vulnerable community. And of course it is true on some level, but not everybody is the same. Not every 60 is the same 60. Not every person is right. The same. So it's really hard to undo a lot of the things that we think, but people must be, you know, really need to be treated with equality and at face value, to listen, you know, not to make a lot of assumptions about what someone is because of their age.
So maybe rather than thinking in age categories, it's really about trying to figure out what a person can contribute or wants to contribute and is interested in. And you would do the same thing with a younger person. Not everybody has the same skill set either, or the same awareness or willingness to do certain things. So I would like to turn the questions over to students. And I have a first one from Alexis. Alexis, would you be willing to just say it and unmute yourself? Are you still around?
Yeah, I'm here. Hold on a second. Can you still hear me?
Yes.
Okay. So you're a huge advocate for citizens in Boston that are 55 and up and who are more susceptible to this COVID-19. I was wondering, how do you think we could design to help keep these citizens safe while in the city? And also, do you think we should put like intense sanitation methods in all buildings to keep them safe?
Yeah, I do. Who cannot be absolutely crushed by what we've seen in nursing homes? I think it's unbelievable. And I think in Massachusetts, it's about 60% of the deaths have come from nursing homes. So something's clearly wrong in this situation. Yes, people tend to be older and more frail. Yes, they tend to have other issues. And that is a factor. You cannot underestimate that. We, you know, for example, I'm actually on a board of the Armenian nursing home in Jamaica Plain. And normally there would be 3 to 5 people who would pass away because they're very old. So that's going to happen. But what could have been different? And is it about design? Yes, it could be. And there are many things that the state is actually trying to implement and wants nursing homes to start complying with in terms of, you know, single rooms, not double rooms, a lot of different things. But there's other aspects too that get at an economic sort of fabric, right? So a lot of the people coming in, and this is not, again, this is not scientific, this is my opinion, a lot of the people coming into the nursing homes have multiple jobs because they get paid very, very little. So I'm talking about the nurse's assistants, probably the nurses to a degree too, anybody who's cleaning, anybody who is doing laundry, anybody who's cooking. A lot of times they have multiple jobs. I believe because people in nursing homes didn't have it, it was brought into the nursing home. It has to be that there is something there. So I'm getting at a larger issue, which is that people have to be paid well for their work so that they can have maybe one job. But the way that it's designed, it's not designed that way. So in some ways it's creating a lot. It's actually creating an unsafe environment for the workers themselves as well as the people. Now the design of nursing homes as well. There's a ProPublica article that came out about nursing home and what happened there. And I know you're not just talking about nursing homes, but they're talking about a whole lot of things, and it has to do with different protocols and regulations that weren't followed because there's a very strong lobby that actually is fighting those regulations. There's a lot of factors going on here. They do have to all be examined as to what the issue is. But in terms of designing a place, you know, like for example, in the Armenian nursing home, I was like, could we have an outdoor space, an outdoor garden? That could be, you know, because people can't get visited. They can't see, you know, is it possible when things start opening up that we could create an outdoor space so that people don't have to be, you know, separated from their loved ones for month after month after month. And we have relaxed those regulations now and then. But basically, I think we have to think in terms of health of the building, health of the air of the building, whether there's a place to go that's outside, the health of the people coming into the building who are providing the care, and all of that leads to a healthy place, whether there's things for people to do, whether there's activities, whether there's, you know, it's a very complex issue. And, I know you're not talking about nursing homes. You're also talking about buildings. Is that right, Alexis?
Yeah, I am.
Yeah. So, I mean, the other thing is that the way we're designing our buildings, if you've ever been into most of our buildings, is, you know, it's very, I mean, obviously it's affordable housing. So a lot of the buildings that they're not really, I mean, there's a huge discrepancy. If you go into a building that there's money in that project, it's totally different. It's beautiful. You know, there's a place in Fenway that's talking about having a movie and an artistic center in the building. That's great. So if you have, if it's a well-funded project and people are going to pay a pretty good amount of rent, then generally they have a lot more. If you're talking about affordable housing, it's a lot more difficult. People don't want to build it. There's not the fight. The federal dollars isn't there as well, right? Since we have, I think it's Section 202 funding from the federal government. I don't think we've gotten any for Or if we do, it's much, much reduced than what it was. So the issue really comes with affordable housing, low income, even maybe more middle income, and creating, being as creative as possible with the spaces when there isn't the amount of money. So can we put a garden? Can you have, someone had mentioned a balcony. You know, someone was saying as simple as design for aging was saying, could we design buildings, so rooms, so that there's actually a balcony for people? That just simple thing would be an amazing. I mean, I talk to people who say they don't even open their windows when it's hot, or when it's, they don't even open their windows. So I think design is huge. Design makes a huge difference. I'm not an architect. Could you do something like a balcony in every room? A common garden, common spaces, even if with limited money, if you're creative, you can do it. I think you can, I think it's possible. And I think we really have to think that the people are living in these buildings. It's not just about putting as many people as you can for as much, as little money as you can. It has to be about the human experience. If we're going to continue building like this, then there's no reason not to try to make it a little more humane and a little more attractive and enjoyable.
Well, it brings in the question of empathy rather than just making a profit. And that's, I think, something we've been struggling with for many, many years now. And maybe there is an opportunity now to look at things differently. But to get back to Alexis's question, I also think that the science around our specific situation has to get more advanced. We don't know fully yet how surfaces should be treated, how often something should be sanitized versus how air treatment and air handling, heating and cooling should be handled. So right now there's a bit of speculation. So we have some data that, like copper, for example, is very good. So could we now start using copper surfaces more in buildings and on surfaces that are touched more? So I think a lot of this will depend on the continuing evaluation of science and actually the medical conditions. And then the other area is things you mentioned that were out there before that are just no-brainers for humans that have nothing to do with a pandemic or not pandemic, that are just necessary to make humans live in a dignified way. So I think those two are coming together ideally. I have another question from Stephen. Are you out there willing to unmute yourself?
Yeah. So you spoke briefly on the inequality of access to technology when you were talking about the transition of the programs to online. So as people obviously don't have this access to these programs or even the most up-to-date information, how can we go about safely making this group of people feel connected and to relay information to them?
Yeah, it's a really good question. I think the best way now is to do both, to continue to try to reach out in digital platforms and also to use the traditional methods as well. So meaning telephone is huge. It really is. Telephone, mail, we're starting to mail. So we have a magazine, we have Boston Seniority magazine. We never mailed it to specific people anymore. It would only be given, put in buildings, but now we're starting to mail the magazine. That's really important because, that's really a way that people are still able to be connected is through getting things in the mail. So I think mail, telephone, and really doing both at the same time. We're going to have to do that for a while, maybe forever. I don't know. I mean, I still like the telephone and the mail myself. But so I think to be able to just not assume that everything is going to be heard online, that's going to be received online. And then you have the whole issue around language access too, because that's a whole other thing in our city, which is incredibly diverse city. Is just be able to have things in multiple languages as much as possible and in multiple ways, whether it's the phone, whether it's digital media channels. And then we are trying, there's amazing organizations like Tech Goes Home, for example, and many, many others, but they do incredible, simple, you can take a class and at the end of the class, you if you pay $50, you get a laptop. If you can't pay the $50, I think there's ways of, entering into a resource request. But there's wonderful organizations that are trying to get, help people with digital literacy. And so I think partnering more and more with them, the libraries are amazing because that's a lot of times the only time people will have a computer is when they go to the libraries. So when they open back up again. So I think helping people who want to learn, some people don't want to learn technology. Really, they don't. Like I'll have people on the phone who say, and I don't know how old they are because I don't ask, and they might be, I may not even be age, but they say, listen, I don't want to learn that. I don't want to learn. I don't want a smartphone. I don't want these things. And they'll actually tell me that they don't want it. Because sometimes I'll say, well, can I send you an email about this request that, you know, about what we're talking about? And they say, I don't want to learn that right now. Then you have other people probably, you know, even really much older people in their 80s and 90s who do know how to use technology. So again, it's not always about how old they are. But so I think being able to hold different needs is very important. And to try to see how can I communicate and how is it best for me to communicate right now with people that I want to reach? And then develop your plan based on that, based on where people are.
Thank you. Good, really good question. I live in Ipswich and I've noticed a lot more flyers popping up. So just things, you know, stapled to a telephone pole, and I now read them. I used to never care. And now I read them, and there's, you know, people making bread that you can pick up in their front steps, and like just interesting stuff. And so the very, very down to earth handing out a piece of paper seems to be coming back in a way that we didn't necessarily anticipate. And so are public displays, so billboards and posters that are just, right, you know, out there for people to walk by. And they're wonderful. They're pretty, you know, they're just there. There's nothing, you know, power outage, still poster's still there. So that's great. I probably have time for one more question before we'll wrap up, because we have another speaker right at 2. I'm wondering if anybody else has a comment or a question, maybe even taking us to a more general health question or a sort of health-related consideration. Connor, please just say it. Take it away.
So I guess what I was just wondering is if there was a way to make technology more age friendly, and such a way, like, so say it's like a simpler user interface where it mimics like older technology, like a typewriter or something similar to that, so that they still know how to use it, but it would be compatible with what the, like, emails and all the current technology we have right now.
I love that idea. I think you should do it, Connor. I think you should design that. I think it would really be incredibly welcomed. I think a lot of it is that it's just so different from what people have used in the past. If you could simulate the way that it was, I think it would make a huge difference. It's a mindset that's hard. There are a lot of resources that I had mentioned. Tech Goes Home. There's a lot of people who've put a lot of effort into trying to help people, older people with technology. Seniorplanet.org, eldersaction.org, where they really break it down. So they're not doing what Connor is saying, which is, well, that I know of, that's designing things in a more simple way, but they are trying to explain it in a very simple way. So Tech Goes Home, agespace.org, seniorplanet.org, eldersaction.org. New York City has done an amazing job where people just really break it down and make it as easy as possible. A lot of the organizations in Boston are doing the same thing. I think Friendship Works is doing that, Operation Able. So there is a lot of efforts being made to try to make technology, you know, so that we can really learn it in a much easier way. So, but I don't know about what the more direct question of Connor saying, you know, that it looks different, looks the way people are used to. So I think that's a nice opportunity. You know, maybe people could actually do that work where you're looking and saying, you know, this is an easier platform because of these features. You know, like I've even found, I think, what was it, WebEx? There's some that are much more cumbersome. Like Zoom, once you get the, you know, the log, you know, once you have the link, you just click on it. So actually it's quite easy. So, but then there's other ones I find that are much harder. I feel like it was WebEx or something like that, where I was just like, what do you do with this? So maybe that's another thing that we could do, you know, is to say, well, these platforms are tend to be more user-friendly across the board.
I think that makes sense. But I think Connor brings up a really interesting issue, and it's not just technology. It is the sense that people are forced to adapt to some status quo that's expected, but that's dynamic. It's changed, you know, these phones change, the apps change. And so I, in the proposition that he's making, or in this sort of idea, I think there is so the sense of allowing different formats to coexist, or allowing different formats to continue to be accessible, and maybe being updated a certain way, because I know that would certainly apply to some of my older relatives. If their computer had a keyboard just like their typewriter had, they would type. And so I think to not disregard that as backwards, but just allowing that, maybe just like disabilities need different formats to access things, mindsets do too. So it would be part of an inclusion to look at these kind of products in a different way. So there are different interfaces, and they don't always suggest, oh, you just have to take this class and you'll get up to speed. Like there's always too bad for you, you don't get it. And about the way Connor put it, I think it's not, it's just, you can do this that way. And let's, you know, let's allow you to, you know, to deal with that interface. And it's not possible for everything, obviously, but there is a point in there. And I definitely, in Germany, I have a lot of relatives who do not use the internet. They just don't. And it's by free choice. It's not by for money reasons. It's not for capability or an intellect reasons. They're just like, I don't want to learn this. So they need to still get their information. And that's, you know, that's a huge difference somehow to everybody else. So it's an interesting. Well, Andrea, thank you so much. This was really inspiring, and I really hope we can share some of the outcome of the projects that are coming down the pipeline, especially if somebody addresses health, and I'm sure there will be health and age related scenarios developed. But thank you so much for joining us, and you guys do amazing work, so I'll definitely keep up with your website. And if anybody wants to volunteer who's in the room, please contact Andrea. I'm assuming there's a portal on your website if you want to get involved. Sounds like there's multiple opportunity there. So thank you very much.
It's amazing. I mean, anyone who wants to, we have incredible events when we do have events that you would absolutely love. So anyone who wants to be involved, I highly recommend it. It's an incredible experience to be with all these older, you know, these people who have incredible knowledge from every part of the world. And it's incredible. You really learn about what Boston is in a really great way. So
thank you.
So thank you. I really appreciate the invitation. I hope it's been helpful. And just, you know, to focus on older adults and trying to make life better really does make life better for everyone. And so I think, I wish you luck. I wish you, all your students, good luck.
Thank you very much.
I have a lot of hope for the younger generation. So
they're the future. Exactly. They're going to do it. Thank you very much.
I believe that.
Have a good afternoon, and hope to talk soon. Bye-bye. Thank you
so much. Bye-bye, everyone. Thank you.
Thank you. And everybody else, I will see you in a few minutes with Harbor Health.